Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Dr. Don Lincoln is a really smart guy. He's got a PhD in experimental particle physics. He works as a senior scientist over at Fermilab. He's also a professor at the Great Courses Plus, our show sponsor today. Now, Dr. Lincoln has a lecture series called The Theory of Everything, The Quest to Explain All Reality. Now, it sounds intimidating, but Professor Lincoln makes the information understandable and accessible to the rest of us as the course gets into stuff like space-time and Feynman diagrams and the Higgs boson, multiverse theory, how we observe the cosmos, how we measure the cosmos using scientific tools, what we know, what we don't know, what we theorize about the origins and the properties of our universe. I really enjoyed the course. I think this audience will enjoy it. Right now, you can sign up for the Great Courses Plus and watch this and any of their over 8,000 online courses for free for 1 month using my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Stream to your phone, your TV, laptop, or desktop and learn something new today. Get your free month. You will love it. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Just FYI, I leave Friday for essentially a week-long tour of several cities in the South. It'll be New Orleans, Jackson, Mississippi, Memphis, Tennessee, Springfield, Missouri, Fort Smith, Arkansas. All the details for all of those events coming up starting this weekend are at thethinkingatheist.com/events. We'd love to meet you. We'd love to have you come out and join us for these thethinkingatheist.com/events. Today's broadcast is the first of a two-part series releasing on consecutive days, today and tomorrow, about free speech. It has, I will admit, a rather provocative title, but it's rooted in an actual instance, an actual circumstance, which took place. The story is a few months old. It will not go away. People still talking about it today. And it's helped to fuel a number of heated, I mean, just really intense online discussions about free speech. What are the acceptable responses when somebody waving a free speech banner just says something hugely toxic and awful and hateful and destructive? We're going to hear from some of our listeners on the show in regard to their perspective. We're going to look at some of the commentary out there on social media. And I've got several activists who are going to join me over the next couple of days, including Melissa Chen of the Global Secular Humanist Movement. I've got Thomas Smith of the Serious Inquiries Only broadcast. We talk about some of the legalities of some of this stuff. And a lightning rod of controversy, somebody that my listeners asked me to have on the show. His name is Dan Errol. He's been on in the past, usually to talk about things like secular parenting or whatever. But lately, he's been saying some extremely provocative things on social media, advocating violence against Nazis. And so Dan and I are going to have a conversation about free speech and violence, where one ends, where the other begins. In January, far-right activist and the man credited with coining the term alt-right was punched in the head. It was the day of Donald Trump's inauguration. Richard B. Spencer, interviewed by a journalist on camera, right there as he's talking, out of the blue, an attacker just clocked him with his fist and sent the guy reeling. The whole event on video and went viral. If you haven't seen it, you can just go to YouTube, Richard B. Spencer punch, and I'm sure it'll pop right up. If you haven't seen it, you're probably one of the few because it's everywhere. And people are sparring, if you'll pardon the expression, over this punch. One side says he's a freaking Nazi. We should make him afraid to spew this kind of vitriol in public. And then the other side says even the worst ideas are protected as free speech and expression under our Constitution. Here are a couple of clips, just some sound bites from Richard Spencer himself. This is an interview he did back in December of last year for Al Jazeera English, as he talked about white nationalism and his opinions on immigrants and immigration.
I am not a white supremacist. I do object to that. Not only is it just a slur word, but it's not accurate.
But you do think that white culture should be supreme in the United States.
I think in the United States was defined by Anglo-Protestants, certainly at the beginning, but particularly after the Civil War, it was defined by this big European family. So America is a white country in terms of its rooted historical identity. Now, things can change. In what direction are we headed? I think we're headed towards obviously a multiracial America, a multicultural America, probably a fragmenting America, probably something that's going to be totally unrecognizable for an American in the 20th century or 19th century. That's where we're headed. I think obviously history can change course if people are dedicated enough and their ideas are powerful enough. America historically is undoubtedly a white country. We're headed in a very different direction.
So what is it that makes America great that other races don't have or share?
Well, only Europeans could be the first ones to go to space. Only Europeans could build something as magnificent as St. Paul's Cathedral or St. Peter's Cathedral. Only Europeans could engage in the kind of scientific discovery that we engage with, that will to kind of keep going, that will to follow reason to its very limit, even if it shatters everything you thought before. There's only Europeans have went through these tumults of reformations, of enlightenment, of, turning on ourselves. Only Europeans can be like this.
And I thought part of what made the United States was it attracted people that wanted to do those kind of things and wanted to succeed. And I thought it was
all of these
that,
things happened in Europe. Being an immigrant, it's kind of pathetic, to be honest. Like, you're just, you're kind of like shuffling off from your own country and you're just entering another one. And you're just kind of taking advantage of what other people have built. Just coming out, washing up on our shore. Give me a break. I wouldn't be proud of a nation of immigrants. I would be proud of a nation of frontiersmen, a nation of colonizers, a nation of conquerors.
On the Inauguration Day video interview, he was doing an on-camera thing for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. He was being asked whether or not he was a neo-Nazi. He said no. And then he was asked about this Pepe the Frog pin that he was wearing. Pepe the Frog is an internet meme that is often used by racists and anti-Semites. It's designated as a hate symbol by the Anti-Defamation League. Apparently, Pepe the Frog began as a totally innocuous thing, and then it was sort of adopted by racist people and racist organizations. And now whenever it's displayed, quite often it becomes a lightning rod for, hey, are you a racist? And while he's explaining the pin on his lapel, Richard Spencer is punched. Now, interestingly, those who are saying that Spencer is protected under the Constitution, and no matter how ugly his words were, he did not deserve to be punched, many of those people are being branded as Nazi sympathizers. How could you come to this guy's defense? Wouldn't you have punched the guards at Auschwitz? Wouldn't you have punched Adolf Hitler? Wouldn't a patriot, wouldn't any moral person have just hauled off and decked Hitler? Now, Nazi, of course, is the common English term for the German Nazi Party of the 20th century. It actually was a derogatory term that was used by the opponents of National Socialism, in reference to the National Socialist German Workers' Party of Adolf Hitler's Germany. I think that party started around 1920, went on for a few decades. And so they sort of abridged the German word for National Socialism to Nazi for short. And it was a derogatory term that kind of stuck. German Nazism specifically endorsed the belief that the Aryan race was the superior race. It was superior to all others, especially the Jews, and that the inferior races were holding the better humanity, the superior humanity, back. Hitler's Nazism also opposed to homosexuality. Now, A lot of people have borrowed the term Nazi for themselves. They are often people who argue the superiority of one demographic or culture or race over another. And they promote the idea that the inferior elements and the inferior people deserve to be minimized and ostracized or even purged outright. And as such, any discriminatory group often finds itself called a Nazi, or proponents of Nazism. Nazi is a popular label that one side will attach to another. Someone they oppose on moral or ideological grounds, they just say, "You're a Nazi." Modern-day neo-Nazism essentially consists of post-World War II social or political movements who want to revive Nazism. And they borrow many of these ideas, ideas like extreme nationalism, racism, discrimination against non-heterosexuals. They focus on a hatred of the Jews. They focus on the doctrine of white superiority. There is, or there was, an American Nazi party. It was founded back in the 1960s. The party itself only lasted a few years, but a bunch of people over the last several decades have borrowed that title for their own groups. You often see Nazi symbolism used by white supremacists. Now, I wanted to sort of dwell on that for just a second. The show has Nazi in the title. But we're not just talking about Nazis. Those who call themselves Nazis are those who are branded by others as Nazis. We're talking about speech. And we're addressing anyone and everyone, a Nazi or otherwise, a white supremacist or otherwise, a racist or otherwise, who is on a platform broadcasting hate, division, discrimination, racism, sexism, damaging myths, dangerous pseudoscience, bad ideas, anything that might be considered the worst of speech, the worst of ideas, often the worst of people doing so. That's the kind of thing we're addressing here. So I'm not limiting the conversation to, should we punch a Nazi? Should we use physical force against anyone and everyone that we find a promoter of hate and destructive ideas? Milo Yiannopoulos is a British alt-right celebrity, if you will. He was a senior columnist, as I understand it, or senior editor for Breitbart News. Breitbart was remains an online uber-conservative news source or outlet. They let him go in February after a video surfaced of Milo endorsing consensual sex between a 13-year-old kid and an adult man or woman. Milo is a member of the alt-right. He's been called a professional troll. There's speculation. He doesn't even believe a damn thing he says. He's just in it for the publicity, but he says some pretty awful stuff. On the 1st of February of this year, he was invited to speak at the University of California, Berkeley. And before the speech happened, a petition went around. More than 100 professors and faculty members at UC Berkeley, more than 100, signed a petition in protest. Please don't invite this guy. Just a bad idea. He's a bad person. A February 1st protest outside the campus started quietly without violence, but it soon erupted. A smaller group sort of interjected and started setting fires, and they threw stones at the police and they smashed property. When it was all said and done, over $100,000 worth of damage done. And again, the internet squares off. One side says it's completely unfortunate, it's counterproductive, the violence, the people turning on law enforcement officers, the destruction of property, this acting out, it's completely inappropriate. And the other side saying it's a natural byproduct of the outrage people feel over an invitation to such an outrageous character who does not deserve a platform. The riots are appropriate. They should be expected. This is the kind of shit that happens when you invite Milo Yiannopoulos. Another controversy at Berkeley, only recently, author and speaker Ann Coulter's speech was canceled over security concerns. The law enforcement in the Bay Area, they paid huge sums of money, upwards, I think, of $500,000, just for overtime and resources as they anticipated more violence over the appearance of Ann Coulter at UC Berkeley. And that's a cost absorbed by taxpayers, even though the speech itself did not take place. When we are confronted with the promotion of really bad ideas, hate, division, discrimination, ugliness, just a tragically wrong-headed person standing upon a very public platform, are we warranted to ramp up the intensity, even to the point of physical force, a fist to the face, a broken window, a stone thrown, a torch, a riot, to push these wrongs back toward obsolescence. I presented the question on social media. A few interesting responses. Jana said, "Is it okay to punch a Nazi? Define Nazi. Oh, wait, it must refer to anyone who has opposing views to you. Isn't that the truth?" And somebody disagrees with you or you disagree with them, they just look at you and say, "Well, you're a Nazi." Philip says, "When to punch a Nazi? Yes, always." Sean said, "My father returned from World War II all fucked up because he was in Europe killing Nazis, you know? The assholes who killed 11 million people and tried to take over the world, and now we're giving these pieces of shit a platform to speak. I wonder if 60 years from now we'll be allowing Al-Qaeda and ISIS apologists to speak at Berkeley." Chris said, "Resort to violence only when the health and safety's at risk." Jacob said this, "My point of view is, if it's okay to assault someone for having obviously horrible beliefs, then it should be permitted for all horrible beliefs." So think about this. If someone who believes abortion is murder, then they should have the right to assault someone who's supporting abortion rights. To that person, abortion's not only as bad as the Holocaust, but it's actually worse, since they believe that every fetus is a person, that there have been more killed since Roe v. Wade than there were in the Holocaust. Even worse, that kind of murder is legal in the U.S. So if it's okay to punch a Nazi, then it should be okay for a pro-life person to punch a pro-choice person. I say it's never okay to harm someone for expressing their opinion, no matter how toxic I may perceive it. Mark said, "Why bother risking breaking your hands on their thick skulls? Bullets are a far more effective and permanent means of dealing with Nazis. You can't oppress minorities when you're dead." And he continues, "Oh, and before my Facebook notifications box is overflowing with condemnations from pacifists lecturing me about how killing is always naughty, 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 let me point out that the right doesn't take your commitment to nonviolence at all seriously. They're not impressed by your acts of civil disobedience. If anything, they appreciate you're doing nothing but singing 'Give Peace a Chance' as they or their buddies in law enforcement curb stomp your heads into the pavement. Indeed, they find it very amusing. The only reason we're still dealing with racism, sexism, homophobia, and other forms of intolerance is because there are no substantial consequences for being a bigot. They're not afraid of us because they know that won't stop them beyond waving signs and chanting slogans. If you want to stop the right's political agenda, you have to make them afraid of the left. You have to hurt them badly enough that they're afraid of rousing your wrath. You need to stomp on them each and every time they poke their heads out from under their rocks, or they will take the opportunity to slither out and undo all that you worked so hard to accomplish. Save your compassion for those who need and deserve it. The right certainly doesn't." George said, "This is not about disagreement on views. This is about some people advocating for the literal extermination of categories of people. We've seen what happens when those particular views are allowed to spread. That can't happen here. People said the same thing about Trump getting elected. We don't need to rehash the whole maybe genocide is good argument ever. That's an idea that every civilized society and every reasonable person can agree is bonkers and not worth considering. If someone insists on bringing that possibility up, then they aren't interested in hearing anything else. I'd rather make an exception to the whole can we all get along and punch a Nazi than risk that idea for having been mistaken for having been accepted." You know, going through the social media comments along this line and seeing some of the emails in my inbox, I'm not really tracking with this idea that not resorting to violence in some way means I'm surrendering or declaring that it's all relative and, hey, what's true for me may not be true for you and all ideas are on a level playing field and I accept you, you know. The idea that I'm not swinging a fist or a bat in your general direction somehow means I support or at least accept your premise and your idea and your platform. So I hear George and other people apparently going along those lines. Hey, you know, you can adopt a kumbaya, let's all buy the world a Coke mentality where you sit around and sway back and forth looking at the stars and expect the world to change, but that's just a fantasy, and that's not what I'm saying at all. I mean, they're making a huge leap between not resorting to violence and being mute and silent and weak and passive. I do not get it. Let's see what our listeners have to say on the switchboard. Area code 724, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. What's your name?
My name is Roger.
We're talking about free speech and the response to bad speech. What's your perspective?
I think that the Constitution, at least as far as I can still gather, gives us the right of free speech. And that means good ideas and bad ideas. But there isn't any way to determine what is a good idea and what is a bad idea unless you are talking about the marketplace of ideas. I think violence is not a very good thing to do.
You think it's counterproductive in the short and long term, or what do you think?
Well, if you take it to its limit, free speech with, let's say, the Islamic perspective of a certain kind of cartoons, we're against that. At least I think we still are against that. We can protest, but we certainly can't give a violent reaction. Otherwise, we're not any better than those that we say we are against. But a protest is completely different than violence. And, you know, as far as like punching Nazis, as far as I can tell, that certainly is counterproductive. We can't really run our society on the fact that I don't like your idea, therefore I'm going to go punch you for it, or I don't like your idea and I'm going to pick up an Uzi and, you know, shoot you for it, or I don't like your idea, I'm going to hit you over the head. That's not what this country was built on.
Do you feel like speech can be threatening? I mean, if someone says something where they say that you as a race or a culture should be wiped out, do you consider that to be some kind of threat that deserves a physical response?
I don't think that any idea on its own is a threat that demands a physical response. Ideas are only ideas. The fact that you can have someone who says something that is so repugnant to you that you want to pick up something and hit them over the head, I can understand that, and that's you know, you could make me extremely angry. Yet that's not the founding principles of this country was built on. We were built on a free exchange of ideas and a free exchange in the marketplace of ideas. We were supposed to be able to determine what ideas are good and what ideas are bad. That's a reasonable thing to determine. If we pick up a pipe and start hitting people over the head, that's not good.
Well, I appreciate you sounding off for the show today. Greatly appreciated, my friend, and thanks for listening. It means a lot.
Okay. Nice talking to you, Seth.
It's been brought to my attention there is a Punch a Nazi video game. It lets you smack virtual members of the alt-right without the inconvenience of heading to a liberal protest. I'm reading from an article about the game. It's produced by a developer named Super Deluxe. And in the game, you can punch Hitler, you can punch Richard Spencer, and Milo Yiannopoulos. I've got area code 712. You're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. What's your name?
Mason.
Mason, we're talking about when to punch a Nazi. We're talking about free speech. We're talking about the reaction to the worst of speech and the presentation of the worst of ideas by often the worst of people. What do you think?
Honestly, I think violence should be a last resort, but I think it needs to still be on the table.
Set up a situation for me. When's violence appropriate, in your opinion?
If I see somebody using any form of hate speech towards any sort of disenfranchised person, I feel I have the need to step in and defend that person to the best of my ability. So,
can we get specific? I mean, what's hate speech, in your opinion?
I don't like using the word, but if I see somebody going up to a black person and saying the N-word, or going up to a gay person and calling them you know the word.
Yeah, we don't need to say the words here. We know what you're talking about. Somebody is using some violent, offensive language, kind of verbally accosting someone, you would go and intervene.
Yep.
I think many of us would want to go and stand next to that person and try to do the right thing. I get that. What's the right thing?
I mean, first off, I mean, it always has to start with words. I mean, you always want to start by trying to change how that person is thinking. if they're thinking something that's a little messed up or a lot messed up, we have to start there, start with diplomacy and work our way forward.
But they're a lifelong racist, right? And they're not going to change how they're thinking in one fell swoop. So there they are, N-word after N-word after N-word after N-word over and over. They won't quit. Now what do you do?
Well, it all depends on the specific situation, but if they're getting agitated and they won't quit or remove themselves from the situation, then we have to start going after them. Violence isn't a great option, but there are times when it is the only option left.
But let's say they're not swinging at you. Let's say they're not being physical. They're not confronting you in a physically threatening way. Right now, we're still in the arena of language. These are just words and ideas. The N-word, the right. N-word, the N-word. Do you instigate with violence? Do you just strike them across the face or get in there, you know, push them back? Do you start that or do you wait till they become physical first?
Personally, I like to think that I would wait, but I really don't know unless the situation is in front of me. I mean, everyone has their own breaking point, you know? And if somebody is making someone else feel unsafe, making somebody feel that like they can't walk down the street, if they don't feel that they can even exist in society, I don't see how that's not violence. I mean, it's words, but it's violence to that person.
So if you run across somebody who wants to remove Jews from the face of the earth, or they just dislike Jews, when does the threat start? When does "I despise you and I hate you," when does that become a physical threat that you have to defend yourself against? How do you gauge that?
Honestly, I can't really tell you. I mean, it's just something you can feel in the situation. The demeanor of the person who they're going after is going to change. I mean, you're going to be able to see that they don't feel safe anymore. They don't feel like they're okay.
What if this person hates Jews, but he doesn't confront somebody on the other side of the street and you run to the rescue? What if they're standing in front of a video camera, a television camera, a radio microphone, and they're saying, "I hate Jews"? Does that person deserve to be decked or a physical response in some way? I mean, is that an incitement of violence?
As long as it stops there, no. I mean, that's not inciting violence as long as they're not trying to recruit other people to cause violence.
So if they perceive then that they think that my hate is at any moment going to translate into me getting violent to them, they can preempt the strike.
I would say so. I mean, doesn't that seem like it's starting to be self-defense at that point? If you're already feeling like you're not safe and that something is going to happen, if he says he wants to take me into a dark alley and beat me with a baseball bat.
But that's different than somebody
we're talking.
That's different than somebody just issuing an idea. That's different than somebody just saying, "Here's what I think. You know, I'm going to kick the shit out of you." It's different than, "I don't like you," or "I think you're beneath me," or, you know, some whatever untoward idea they might have. There's a difference between saying, "Hey, I'm going to kick your ass. I'm going to make you pay. I'm threatening your life or your safety." It's the difference between that and saying, "I just don't like you for whatever reasons I brought to the table." And I think that's the distinction I'm trying to make on the show is, you know, if the KKK holds a parade in the street, they are proffering some of the worst of ideas. Do they deserve a physical response by the anti-racists who show up with, you know, baseball bats and brass knuckles and just say, "It's on," right? The KKK, we need to make them afraid to even promote these horrible ideas. And I think that's the distinction I'm trying to define here, if we can. How do we know the difference? How do we know where the line is drawn? This subjective line that's different with every person, right?
I think it's fairly safe to say that the line is drawn with humanity. I mean, a racist doesn't see a black man as human. They don't see Jews as human beings. I mean, we have to make that distinction. I mean, there's a difference between standing up for groups of people and standing up to try to exterminate those people or to say that they're less than human.
Well, there's a difference between saying someone is not human and saying that they're inferior. I think there are some racists out there that are like, yeah, they're people, but they're lesser people. I mean, there are those who don't completely dehumanize. I'm not trying to excuse or equivocate, but I'm saying that.
Oh, trust me, my U.S. congressman is one of those people.
But when the U.S. congressman says or implies something unfortunate like that, when you see him at a rally, is the proper response to make him afraid to even utter the words because you might carry out physical violence against him?
I would say the proper response to him is vote him out. I mean, we need to make it so that these types of people don't have platforms. They can have a platform, but we don't have to give it time. Like, we don't have to give them the time of day that they use, you know?
So using a form of expression, meaning the expression of you at the voting booth and you promoting better ideas and perhaps a better candidate to remove the bad candidate with the awful ideas, you would be working within a system of laws and a process to be able to get this person out of the picture, but you would be able to do so without violence in that instance.
Right. And I started by saying, I mean, we have to make violence the last resort.
You realize the minefield it is, though, because, I mean, if everybody's drawing their own line as to where that moment is.
Yes, I do. And I wrestle with it still. But I just don't think that if somebody's calling for the extermination of an entire group of people, we should let that person keep talking if those people are afraid of them.
Do you think there are such things as violent words?
Well, I mean, in this country, we've already established that words can be violence. I mean, we prosecute people for domestic abuse. Even if there's no actual physical abuse, it's still violence. Psychological damage is just as valid.
So if someone is using verbal abuse against someone else, it's then appropriate to use physical force against them?
I think it can be.
All right. Anything else on the subject while we're talking? Anything else on your mind?
Well, I had a list, but I don't think any of it really comes up right now, so I think we're good.
All right. Well, I appreciate your perspective on the show. It's a hot topic, you know. It's obviously a minefield, and we're going to try to navigate through and further clarify in what I hope is a reasonable forum for these ideas to try to figure out, you know, what it all means. So thanks for lending your voice to the conversation. Much appreciated.
All right. Thank you, Seth.
I'd like to read an article that was published in March of this year in The Atlantic by Peter, is it Beinart? It's called A Violent Attack on Free Speech at Middlebury. It says this, "My fellow liberals, please watch the following video," and there's an attached video. "It suggests something has gone badly wrong on the campus left. The events leading up to the video are as follows. One of the student groups at Middlebury College is called the American Enterprise Club. According to its website, the club aims, quote, to promote free enterprise, a limited federal government, a strong national defense. In other words, it's a group for political conservatives. This year, the AEI Club invited Dr. Charles Murray to speak. That's crucial to understanding what followed. When leftists protest right-wing speakers on campus, they often deny that they are infringing upon free speech. Free speech, they insist, does not require their university to give a platform to people with offensive views. That was the argument of the people who earlier this year tried to prevent ex-Breitbart writer Milo Yiannopoulos from speaking at the University of California at Berkeley. And it was the argument of those who opposed Murray's lecture at Middlebury. Quote, this is not an issue of freedom of speech, declared a letter signed by more than 450 Middlebury alums. Why has such a person been granted a platform at Middlebury? The answer is, according to the article, that Middlebury granted Murray a platform because a group of its students invited him. Those students constitute a small ideological minority. They hold views that many of their classmates oppose, even loathe. But the administrators who run Middlebury, like the administrators who run Berkeley, consider themselves obligated to protect the right of small, unpopular minorities to bring in speakers of their choice. denying them that right, giving progressive students a veto over who conservative students can invite, comes perilously close to giving progressive students a veto over what conservative students can say. If it's legitimate for campus progressives to block speeches by Milo Yiannopoulos or Charles Murray, why can't they block speeches by fellow students who hold Yiannopoulos or Murray's views? Some of Murray's views are indeed odious. 23 years ago, he co-authored The Bell Curve, which argued that differences in intelligence account for much of the class stratification in American life, that intelligence is partly genetic, and that there may be genetic differences between races. Skipping down just a few paragraphs in the article. To appreciate the ugliness of what transpired at Middlebury, however, one needs to look not merely at the principles involved, but at the specific sequence of events. In its letter to the campus explaining its invitation to Murray, the AEI Club declared that it invites you to argue. It invited a left-leaning Middlebury professor, Allison Stanger, to engage Murray in a public conversation following his talk, thus ensuring that his views would be challenged. In his introduction to Murray's speech, a representative from the AEI Club implored his fellow students to debate Murray rather than shouting him down. But they did shout him down. As Murray approached the podium, dozens of students in the audience turned their backs, loudly read a prepared statement, and then began chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Charles Murray has got to go. Your message is hatred. We cannot tolerate it. Charles Murray, go away. Middlebury says no way." And finally, "Shut it down." Here's the audio of just a few seconds from that protest. After close to 20 minutes of this, a university representative came on stage to announce that if the students did not relent, Murray and his interlocutor, Professor Stanger, would move to a secret location from which their conversation would be broadcast. Professor Stanger then took the microphone and asked the students, "Can you just listen for 1 minute?" Many in the audience replied, "No." She added that, "I spent a lot of time preparing hard questions." Finally, she conceded that, "You're not going to let us speak." As the university representative announced that Murray and Stanger would move to a different location, the crowd began shouting, "Where are you going?" Somehow they found out, because when Murray and Stanger finished their dialogue, they found themselves surrounded by protesters. The protesters, some of whom were wearing masks and may not have been Middlebury students, began pushing them. When Stanger tried to shield Murray, according to a Middlebury spokesman, a protester grabbed her hair and twisted her neck. Murray, Stanger, and their escorts made it to a waiting car, but the protesters pounded on it, rocked it back and forth, and jumped on the hood, according to the New York Times. One took a large traffic sign attached to a concrete base and placed it in front of the car to prevent it from leaving. Finally, Murray and Stanger got away. They'd planned to eat dinner at a local restaurant, but upon learning the protesters planned to disrupt their meal, they left town altogether. Stanger later went to a hospital where she received a neck brace. This is not a tale of university cowardice. To the contrary, the Middlebury administration took extraordinary measures to ensure that Murray could speak. And in a letter following the incident, President Lori Patton declared that in their response to Murray's speech, some Middlebury students, quote, "failed to live up to our core values." She publicly apologized to Murray. The article finishes, "Still, that's not enough. College policy declares that, quote, Middlebury College does not allow disruptive behavior at community events or on campus. Many of the students protesting Murray's speech clearly violated that policy. I hope they are punished," says the author. "If they are, perhaps progressive students will think twice before shouting down a conservative speaker the next time." Liberals may be tempted to ignore these incidents either because they're uncomfortable appearing to defend Charles Murray or because in the age of Donald Trump they're worried about bigger things. That would be a mistake. If what happened at Berkeley and now at Middlebury goes unchallenged, sooner or later liberals will get shouted down too. To many on the campus left, after all, Zionism is a racist ideology. Drone attacks constitute war crimes. Barack Obama was the deporter-in-chief. Hillary Clinton supported a racist crime bill. Joe Biden disrespected Anita Hill. There will always be justifications. Professor Alison Stanger is a liberal. Last week, she ended up in a neck brace merely for being willing to ask Charles Murray hard questions. She should serve as an inspiration and a warning of things to come. For reference, I will link the article here from The Atlantic in the description box of this broadcast. Area code 803, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. What's your name?
Peter.
Peter, we're talking about free speech and an appropriate time, if ever, to punch a Nazi or somebody you feel is a purveyor or promoter of bad ideas, bad speech, even threatening speech. What's your perspective?
I don't really see any problem with doing it. I don't really see any problem with hitting them. I don't think it's a form of censorship, more as it is consequences.
Like if you say this, get ready because you've got it coming.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, you and I both live in the South. You live in, what, Oklahoma?
Mm-hmm.
I live in South Carolina. We both know that there are consequences for us coming out as atheists, which can include things like losing our jobs and other things, alienation. Why shouldn't there be consequences for their bad speech and their bad ideas?
What if those consequences are, in fact, illegal? I mean, we're talking about assault. Is it still appropriate?
I think so, but I also believe that the ends justify the means.
So somebody looks at you and says, you know what, you're an atheist, and the words that come out of your mouth offend me. I just think you're repulsive to me. Would somebody then have the right to go after you? I mean, a fist to the face? Somebody punched you out. Would you think that was appropriate? You know, you had it coming, right?
I could try. I'm not going to say that they don't have the right to do it. I mean, they can try.
You're not worried at all about the laws against? I think what I'm trying to figure out is, how do you draw the line? How do you decide when the letter of the law can be ignored because it's justifiable physical force in response?
Well, I think that has to do with the points of self-defense. I mean, some people could see that getting rid of the hate speech is self-defense. They're defending themselves and what they believe in. And when it comes to self-defense, those laws are not as clear as simple assault laws are.
So for you, verbal assault is the same as physical assault, then? If someone was saying something ugly, something hateful, that to you could be considered a verbal assault?
Yes, but like everything, there's nuances.
So let's say you're standing next to somebody else who has a different perspective on what is offensive, what is hateful. Between you two, how do you decide when physical force starts?
That's a personal point. You have to decide if it's worth it, because like I said, we both know that there would be consequences. You have to decide if the consequences are worth your actions.
Okay. So if you punch the Nazi or the white supremacist or the racist or the sexist or whoever, what happens next? I mean, what's your expectation?
Well, first I expect the cops to be called.
No, I mean, before the cops get there, do they strike you back? Do you continue to hit them until they're unconscious? Do you incite other people around you to join in? I mean, what's the move?
Well, no, you only hit them until they get off of you. That's once again what I was saying about the laws for self defense and the laws for assault. If you hit
I'm not talking about somebody who's coming after you physically. I'm talking about someone who is flapping their gums. They're using words, so he's not physically on you. And he's not grabbing you by the shirt collar. He's not wrestling you to the ground. He's not punching you. There's no physical contact. Right now, we're in the arena of words and ideas. So if someone's speaking in an ugly or hateful way, you're saying that that could be considered assault, even verbal assault. Am I tracking here?
Yes.
And you make a subjective decision as to when you just land the punch. Even if it's the first punch, the first blow can come from you. You find it appropriate.
I do.
And after the first punch, what happens? What do you expect them to do in response?
I don't know. I guess it would depend on the person.
Most what would you do if you'd just been punched? What would you do if you were saying something someone else didn't like and they decked you? How would you respond?
I'd fight back.
So you return fire, so to speak.
Yes.
And then what happens? We're talking about escalation. We're talking about essentially a fist fight in the middle of a public place, wherever that happens to be, or even a private place. The response is going to be, for them, self-defense, physical self-defense, because you struck first, correct?
Correct.
Would that not be appropriate if they felt their physical safety was in jeopardy?
No, that would be appropriate.
So then you strike them and they strike you back and you both have come to blows. Then what happens?
I don't know.
I mean, what is solved by striking the guy in the face or wherever and having a fist fight erupt out of what was a disagreement of ideas? What is accomplished at the end of the day? Are you trying to make them afraid to open their mouths the next time? Will you create a martyr if they feel like because they were attacked, they are now a victim and they can play the victim card? What happens once you land the first punch and they respond with another punch?
Well, let me see. I do think it would end up with a fist fight until somebody breaks it up. And as to whether it would solve anything, I don't know. But I do think that there's a certain point where words and being rational fails.
If they call the cops, I mean, what do you say to them?
Me, I would personally say, you know, he said something that offended me. I felt that I was in danger.
You were in danger from his words?
Yes, because words can lead to actions.
But had he acted yet, or was he just telling you what he thought?
No, he wasn't. He hasn't acted yet.
Okay, so he has not yet acted in a way that was harmful to you or put you in physical danger. But you anticipated that at any moment he might.
Yes.
Any other thoughts on this?
Well, I think the issue is more complicated than yes or no. Like everything, it's got nuances in it.
If we're talking about nuance and we're talking about subjective human perception, where everybody brings their own baggage, everyone brings their own filter, everyone brings their own opinion and attitude, and everyone's drawing that line in a different place, do you see that as potentially problematic? What if someone draws the line way, way over here at the beginning, where all they have to do is see someone they think is an agent of hateful ideas, and just the sight of them causes them to feel threatened and they go and throw a punch? How do you decide where the line's going to be drawn in a civilized culture that is managed with a rule of law? How do you decide where the line is drawn?
That's what the law is there for.
But you just broke the law.
Yes, and I have to live with the consequences of that.
Okay.
Once again, and I have to balance whether it's worth me breaking the law and going to jail to let this guy get away with saying whatever they're saying.
So for you, it's a cost-benefit thing. I mean, you're willing to take a ride downtown, you're willing to spend a night in jail as long as the message is delivered that your hateful speech will not be tolerated.
Yes.
All right. Well, I appreciate you sharing your perspective on the radio. Much appreciated.
Thank you. You have a nice day, Seth.
Coming up in just a second, I'm going to talk to Melissa Chen. She is one of the editors for the Global Secular Humanist Movement site and organization. She is a computational biologist, the product of MIT, and has worked for Harvard. She's an activist and an atheist, and she has been out there on the front lines of many of these discussions in regard to what is hate speech, what is free speech. I'm going to talk to Melissa Chen, and we're going to get into the story of the recent investigation by police in Ireland against Stephen Fry for breaking blasphemy laws. What the hell's going on? They're going after Stephen Fry and others. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more on the other side of this. Hang on. Don't Don't forget, my listeners get a 100% commercial-free version of the broadcast and a bonus show every single month. Thank you so much for your support on Patreon. If you want to become a patron, you can go to patreon.com/SethAndrews. Joining me on the radio is Melissa Chen. Melissa, I was going to introduce you as one of the editors, at least, of the global secular humanist movement, but you're going through kind of a sea change at this moment, right? There's a big transition. You want to describe what's going on?
So the global secular humanist movement was something that was started by Faisal Said Al-Mukhtar, who is an Iraqi refugee who came to the United States about 3 years ago. And he's very active on the secular speaking circuit at conferences and things like that. But we finally are able to sort of parlay this huge following that he's built over the years from this Facebook page that he started back in Baghdad, and sort of parlay that into an actual nonprofit organization with actual programs to do things. And that's where we're at now. So I'm, you know, was a career scientist, and I'm leaving that to join his organization. It's called Ideas Beyond Borders. And the purpose of it is to promote the free exchange of ideas, free speech, and it's also pro-human rights and democracy and secularism around the world.
You had mentioned, Faisal, you'd mentioned free speech. I've been following this story about how there's seems to be a concentrated campaign against many atheist Facebook pages, secular yeah. Facebook pages, and those of ex-Muslims. I don't know if it's like do they call it false flagging, where they just have these campaigns and they try to shut these pages down and Facebook's algorithms kick in and the editors or founders of the pages just log in one day to find that all their stuff has disappeared. Do you want to speak to any of that? Is it real, and what can we do about it?
It appears to be real. I know it's happened to our friends at the Ex-Muslims of North America and also Atheist Republic. It's happened to us several times. I would say like every year there will be like maybe one or two shutdowns, bans, where all the editors, all the admins of the page will get their profile sort of disabled for a while.
Yeah, they did it to me last year. I mean, there was, I don't know, I think it was some religious page or whatnot just launched a concentrated campaign, and I logged in one day. And the Thinking Atheist, everything was gone. I mean, it's just gone. No announcement. There was no notice. And I think to myself, how monumentally thin-skinned do you have to be to say that these ideas don't deserve a page or a platform? And how insecure are you about your God if you think that you have to go and falsely flag a page to protect his message? To me, it makes no sense.
Well, when your ideas cannot exist with other ideas, that says something about how much faith you have or how much confidence you have in your beliefs to begin with.
Melissa, you're an activist. What's your opinion on some of the most dangerous speech that's out there, and how should we respond to it? What do you think?
That's an interesting question. So, and I don't know whether what we're seeing right now with Facebook depublishing or restricting the audience of these atheist pages has anything to do with the fact that what's also been in the news for Facebook is Pakistan, for example, requesting that Facebook report any pages to them that might be sharing or producing blasphemous content, right? So we're seeing authoritarian governments asking Facebook to work with them to, you know, in the interest of national security. That's always the justification. And then you also have this problem that Facebook has been having with live broadcasting of crimes happening. So there seems to be an effort to clamp down on this, right? Because that is horrendous, to see somebody being murdered or raped live on Facebook, you know, before Facebook even gets to shutting down the feed. It can be very traumatic for so many people. So I think all this is happening in concert, and we just haven't figured out from an engineering and systematic standpoint, how are we going to draw these limits? I mean, it's difficult legally, it's difficult socially to define, like, you know, who is the one spouting hate speech? Is it the Islamists? Is it the atheists that are blaspheming against Allah? And once you think about that, how do we go about it from an engineering standpoint to automate the process? Because can it be automated? Can we train AI? I mean, the implications of this is just, and I don't envy Facebook, honestly. It's a terrible situation to be in.
Well, there's a narrative out there, and you see in lazier circles these protests, and they usually go along the lines of Mark Zuckerberg hates atheists. And then they want to do some sort of change.org petition that's going to accomplish nothing. And I'm like, trust me, Mark Zuckerberg is not sitting around in his evil lair hand deleting atheist pages. There's something else going on.
I know. And it's a systematic issue at Facebook scale. I mean, they're operating at a scale that's unseen in the world, right? Nobody has ever had to deal with this. And there's just so much noise to signal. How do we amplify the signal to noise ratio? I mean, that is an engineering question also. And it's already difficult for humans in our minds to sort of conceptually define where we're going to draw the lines between, you know, speech that is allowed, not allowed, what is censorship, what is not, let alone for a system to be completely automated and computerized to tackle this problem.
What is offensive speech to you? Is there such a thing as a word or an idea that should not be seen or heard?
A word, a specific word? I don't think so. Well, unless, of course, there's the legal aspect of this and there's the social aspect of this. I think if you're in social exchanges and in the conversation, if I knew the person I'm talking to has trauma from the past and some word easily triggers them out of courtesy, yes, absolutely, I would avoid that word. I mean, why antagonize somebody on purpose? But legally, do we have to put these boundaries around speech that we, for whatever reason, determine as a society that absolute no-go? For example, I think in Europe, they do the Holocaust denial itself is a crime in some countries, and most notably in Germany. And the question is, has that done anything to actually eradicate Holocaust denial in Germany? Has that, in fact, caused any inflammation of conspiracy theories? And how can you say that for this specific issue, we're not going to go there, but other genocides are up for, you know, denial? Maybe the Armenian genocide is up for denial. Then you don't really have any moral high ground if you are German to really say anything about Turkish Armenian genocide denial. That's the issue for me. I think the United States has it right on the free speech issue. We have legal protections for some speech, but that is very much restricted to speech that incites violence and has a credible cause for fear of imminent danger. So like when Madonna, for example, was on the podium saying she wants to storm the White House and, you know, kill the president, President Trump, you know, a lot of people were like, oh, no, you know, like it was the right who was up in arms about this. Like, oh, you know, she's threatening. Yeah, but it's not credible. So she was never charged. There was nothing to look into that because what her speech was seen as a figure of speech, a metaphorical rallying cry against the attempts to resist the government. She was obviously not physically advocating that we go in with AK-47s and take Trump down like Olympus has fallen.
Yeah, but this is the gray area, right? How do you determine intent? How do you know? How do you know she didn't really want to go in and storm the Bastille kind of thing? And that's the argument that's often being made. It's an incitement and it deserves a response. And then we get into beyond a legal response when the law hasn't kicked in yet. What about a cultural response? This is good people keeping other people in check. It's a necessary evil, if you will. Do you want to speak to the use of violence against those who are the promoters of hate?
Yes, I think that was the most apparent case of that was on Inauguration Day this year when Richard Spencer was punched in the face, or I guess you can call it alt-high-fived in the face.
we led the show with that story, but I wasn't using that particular term, and I got to write that down. Alt-high-five. Okay, got it. Yeah, that was sort of the lightning rod for the whole rest of the conversation, sure.
It was, you know, it was a live interview, it was broadcast, went viral, and it triggered an internet-wide debate about the moral philosophy of punching Nazis, which I think was really interesting. And the thing about Richard Spencer is he's a white supremacist, obviously, and he's called for peaceful ethnic cleansing to halt the destruction of European culture. So he's definitely a self-identified leader of the alt-right. But regardless, this one picture, this live feed of this person just sucker punching Richard in the face, you know, don't get me wrong, it's very hard not to acknowledge this glee on a very visceral level of seeing someone who espouses views as abhorrent as Spencer's getting punched. But in the same way, it's just as satisfying seeing Indiana Jones punch the Nazi or Captain America punch Hitler in the comics. But there's a reason why that's fiction. I mean, we're dealing here with, you know, our society. And when I stood against this punching Nazis business, because, I mean, for many reasons, and I'll get into that later. But one of the first pushback, the pushback you get if you try to defend and say that, no, we should not advocate for this kind of mob violence in society, this is often mistaken for actually defending Nazism by default. Like, oh, if you're defending Richard from getting punched in the face, you are actually defending his views. It's taken to mean the same thing, but it is absolutely not. It's based on principle. It's the same reason why defending somebody's right to free speech does not mean endorsing the contents of that speech. It's exactly the same thing. And one of the arguments I heard was, oh, you know, we live in an age where people are trying to normalize white supremacism, racism, and Nazism. Yes, but punching back merely normalizes violence. And that's dangerous. That's what's not worth the glee of seeing Richard getting punched in the face.
So I'll play devil's advocate. Emma, these people aren't going to respond to reason. They're not listening to reason anyway. I mean, if they're not going to change their minds and we can't reach them in the arena of language and ideas, then physical violence, well, that seems the natural next step, right?
Well, the first question for me, if somebody says that, is, you know, how does punching somebody, like, does it physically dislodge the racist idea from their skull? I can't see how that works. But I think the sort of reasoning behind that is more that, oh, we want to make the environment or the climate so unwelcoming, so intolerant to these ideas. And punching Richard is a way of showing that he's just not welcome anywhere in society. I think that's what they're trying to justify. But my question to them is, mob vigilantism is basically this, like, it's a powder keg. You really don't know when it's going to blow up in your face. And further, there's other nonviolent social mechanisms that can make life very difficult for somebody with views like Richard's. I mean, think of like the gay rights revolution, right, that happened in this country. We didn't have to punch people who practiced homophobia, you know, who was against the existence of gays or trying to make lives extreme. Like, they were extremely homophobic and, you know, they didn't have any civil rights. They had no right to marry who they loved. And they suffered drastic cases of discrimination in employment everywhere socially. But we didn't go around punching those people who were homophobic, who denied the status of human dignity to these LGBT folks. So why do we feel that we have to do it in this case? Because there are people who are ex-skinheads, who are ex-KKK, people who have sort of reasoned themselves out of it. And yeah, I guess, like you said, it is probably a huge minority. But I'm not sure if we can cling to this idea that everyone is just hopeless, because then we will never see people that step away from indoctrination, whether it's religion, whether it's Islamism. You know, someone like Majid Nawaz, he managed to get out of it. Why won't we give people the benefit of the doubt that reason or some sort of other, you know, processes can actually help them step out of their view? Because I'm going to just punch everybody in the face like that, then we're basically condemning them and saying, there's no hope for you. You can't be reasoned with at all. That's not a very charitable view of humanity. That's not a very humanistic view of humanity.
Melissa Chen, any final thoughts before I move on? Anything left to add on free speech and the response to bad speech?
Yeah, the thing that really gets me about mob violence and the danger of it is just the vigilantism is about groupthink and herd mentality. And when we subvert due process, it becomes very dangerous because, you know, is this really a society that you want to live in? I mean, imagine how it can be used to settle personal scores. You start seeing similarities also between Islamists and these Antifa people who say, you know what, it's okay to punch Nazis on the streets like that. Because what happens is they're now conflating speech with violence. And they're saying, okay, this is so hurtful, the consequences are so bad, whether it's blasphemy, apostasy, or just the consequences of spreading these like racist ideas, that it's so dangerous that the speech itself, so you're preemptively, before any actual action has taken place, you're saying that this speech must be met with violence. And there are similarities there in how these Islamists and also, you know, these people who are cheering on or are actively wanting to punch Richard in the face are, that's the world that they're advocating for. And there are similarities there. That should give them pause.
Melissa Chen, who in just a few days will be entering that new endeavor over at Ideas Beyond Borders. Do you guys have a website yet, or does that come later? Or
that will come later.
Well, I'll make sure and throw some links out when you guys go live and all the dust settles. Let us know how things are going. You know, obviously we want to be about ideas, but we also like to see those ideas translate into action. And I know that you and Faisal and so many others have been out there really working to try to promote better ideas. Melissa Chen, thanks so much for joining me for the show and for your perspective. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you so much, Seth. And thanks for all that you do with the Thinking Atheist.
So the story broke at the first part of May that in Ireland, somebody had seen an interview that Stephen Fry had done back in February of 2015, where he had been pretty tough on the idea of God. He was asked, what would you say to God if you had the chance? And Stephen Fry's response was brilliant. Here's the clip.
Suppose it's all true, and you walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I will basically, what's known as the Odyssey, I think, I'll say, bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? That's what I'd say.
And you think you're going to get in
no,
on that?
But I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to get in on his terms. They're wrong. Now, if I died and it was Pluto, Hades, and if it was the 12 Greek gods, then I would have more truck with it, because the Greeks were, they didn't pretend not to be human in their appetites and in their capriciousness and in their unreasonableness. They didn't present themselves as being all-seeing, all-wise, all-kind, all-beneficent. Because the God who created this universe, if it was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac, utter maniac, totally selfish, totally. We have to spend our life on our knees thanking him? What kind of God would do that?
Now, somebody who asked to remain anonymous found that that response was offensive or blasphemous. And Ireland has a defamation act. The Defamation Act of 2009 says a person who publishes or utters blasphemous material shall be guilty of an offense. Well, good luck nailing that one down. Good luck determining where the lines are drawn on that particular statute. What's an offense? The video has been seen on YouTube more than 7 million times. I'm wagering those numbers go up even now after all of this insanity, all of these headlines. The complainer telling police he believes Stephen Fry had committed criminal offenses under the Defamation Act. Police have dropped the charges. They said there was a lack of interest. Go figure. There was plenty of interest in Jakarta as governor, and I'm going to butcher this name, Basuki Tahaja Pranama, commonly known as Ahok. Hey, I can do that. Ahok. Ahok has been sentenced to 2 years in prison. He was found guilty of blasphemy. The trial started last December over accusations that the governor insulted Islam while he was campaigning for re-election. He apparently quoted a verse from the Quran last year, attempting to prove to his supporters that there were no restrictions on Muslims voting for a non-Muslim politician. And because he said this, he was brought up on charges. And he has been convicted 2 years in prison. Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim country with 87% of the population, more than 200 million people, declaring that they are followers of Islam. There's a story that's been out there for the past, I think, couple of weeks now, in regard to comedian and talk show host Stephen Colbert and the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Now, let me give you some backstory on the FCC. I'm a former FM radio broadcaster. We used to fret a lot about the FCC. They had specific standards and requirements for broadcasting. You had to broadcast within the power that was allowed by the FCC for your radio station. You have to follow certain protocols. You have to station ID a certain amount of times. I get that. But they also, in many ways, functioned as a kind of censorship board. So if you said damn on the radio, well, that's fine. But if you say shit on the radio or something else, you can be fined, and or your radio station can be fined, and you might be suspended or fired. There's a standard of censorship in place, supposedly, in the FCC. If somebody complains to them, can come after you. And we've seen this on award talk shows. You know, somebody will make a joke, or they'll utter a swear word, or somebody has a wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl, you know, and somebody sees a nipple. And people freak out and they protest to the Federal Communications Commission and the FCC, in charge of sort of censoring broadcasts. They can issue a fine, some sort of penalty. Well, Stephen Colbert has been just skewering President Donald Trump. And a couple of weeks ago, Colbert did this, I mean, in-your-face rant. He just went off. He said, you're not the POTUS, the P-O-T-U-S, the President of the United States. He said, you're not the POTUS, you're the BLOTUS, you're the glutton with the button, you're a regular gorge Washington, you're the presidents, but you're turning into a real prick-tator. Sir, you attract more skinheads than free Rogaine. You have more people marching against you than cancer. You talk like a sign language gorilla who got hit in the head. In fact, the only thing your mouth is good for is being Vladimir Putin's cock holster. Now, this last line has gotten Colbert in a ton of hot water from multiple sides. Some felt it was a homophobic slur, and they're protesting on that front, and others say it's just offensive, and they have protested to the FCC, and then the FCC responds with an investigation. Does Stephen Colbert deserve to be fined or fired or whatever? Now, in regard to censorship and ratings, I've obviously changed my tune quite a bit since I was a hardcore conservative Christian. I'm not one of those people who believes that young children should have immediate 24-hour access to quote-unquote adult material. I mean, I do think parents do have to filter a lot of this stuff through to make sure that the child is ready to receive or hear or see whatever it's going to be. But I also think we're kidding ourselves if we think that most of the censorship that takes place really does anything. If somebody bleeps the word shit on NBC, is there anyone in this country who doesn't know what the word was that was just bleeped? How often is a film or television show or radio broadcast made better when someone goes in and slices out a part of a conversation or the part of a love scene or part of an action sequence to make it acceptable for the rest of us? And who doesn't know it's been edited out? And who can't find the original whenever and however they want? Well, I'm not going to make this whole broadcast about censorship and the FCC, but it does speak to the freedom of speech, the freedom of being able to express yourself in specific ways and who is allowed to hear it. And I had written an article a couple of years ago about a documentary I have seen on Netflix. And if it's still on Netflix, you should totally check it out. It's called This Film Is Not Yet Rated. And the film asked the question, who are these anonymous and unaccountable censors who are at another censorship organization, the Motion Picture Association of America? A standards and practices board. Upright citizens deciding what the rest of us should and shouldn't be able to see and how restricted that material should be. There's a really tenacious private investigator who did some research on the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, and he found out that they're largely religious people. In fact, I think the MPAA, as it stands, has two clergy members on staff. These people decide whether a film gets a PG or an X or an NC-17 or NR-17. And they are anonymous and essentially unaccountable. They're just mystery men and women who base a film's rating and release options on their own, often religious, definition of morality. They decide what they think we should see and hear. And it's interesting as well to note how often violence gets the R rating and nudity and sex gets the NC-17. Like a chainsaw to the face, oh, that's fine, that's rated R. A same-sex couple making love, hell, any couple making love for too many on-screen seconds, that requires intervention by the MPAA. And of course, you have to wonder if these Puritans who are at the MPAA, the clergy and otherwise, are watching all this lurid material and secretly kind of enjoying themselves. Right? They have to watch it. It's part of their job. It's often been said that obscenity is one of the most ill-defined terms in terms of culture, in terms of law. It bends and moves wildly. It's based on these subjective individual interpretations. What is obscene? One person's grotesque display of bare skin is another person's artistic celebration of the human experience. What one parent says is totally unacceptable for any person to view, whether you're adult or kid. Another parent sees it's a healthy reflection of the real world. It's a piece of art, or it's a piece of commentary that deserves to be seen, or it deserves to be released, and then we can decide whether to see it. And as we talk about what Stephen Colbert should and shouldn't be able to say on his own show, I'm reminded of the George Carlin, 7 Dirty Words You Can't Say on Television and the Filthy Words lawsuit that actually ended up at the Supreme Court. Just a short version of that story. It's an iconic comedy routine by the late George Carlin, the 7 Dirty Words You Can't Say on Television. Well, a New York radio station played the Filthy Words monologue, a recording of that, on drive time radio in the afternoon. This is back in 1973. And a dad's driving along and he hears the George Carlin routine on the radio. He's got his 5-year-old son in the car. Does he shut the radio off and say, next? No. He complains to the Federal Communications Commission and a lawsuit ends up at the Supreme Court. And the final ruling, which ended up at the Supreme Court in like 1978, was that the Carlin routine was indecent but not obscene. Now, good luck defining these terms. Good luck pinning these down, filtering through the subjective eyes and ears and perceptions and attitudes of the people using them. Does this material, whether it's art or commentary, good or bad, ugly or beautiful, does it have a right to be heard in a free speech culture? What are the boundaries? What are the limits of the First Amendment, the constitutional protection of free speech and expression? If the religious person was offended by Stephen Fry, does he have a right to punch Stephen Fry for being hateful to God? Do Islamic fundamentalists have the right to imprison the governor of Jakarta for just offering an opinion, a perspective about the Quran and Allah? Does Stephen Colbert deserve the level of outrage that he is receiving here in the United States and beyond for what he said about Donald Trump? He's a comedian and commentator and entertainer. He is in a business that is all about going after the powerful with provocative language, the edgy punchline, the zinger designed to shock an audience into disbelieving laughter. It's what comedians do. And for those who would claim, and I disagree with this, but those who would claim that Stephen Colbert was a promoter of hate speech, does he deserve then to be punched by the people who consider him hateful? I mean, physical violence. Just take a fist to his face whenever you get the next chance. He has it coming. Let's make him afraid to say those things in public. Is that the kind of world we want to live in? Tomorrow morning, part 2 of this discussion releases. And the very first interview, the very first conversation, is between myself and an atheist activist named Dan Errol. And Dan thinks, yes, we should create a culture, an environment where those who promote hate speech should be scared to open their mouths in public. And that sometimes a physical response is appropriate to what he terms violent speech. I'm going to speak with Dan Errol about these perspectives. Plus, I'm going to talk to Thomas Smith with the Serious Inquiries Only podcast, more of your emails and phone calls for the broadcast. The conversation continues tomorrow on part 2 of When to Punch a Nazi, a conversation about free speech. Thank you so much for listening.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.